the story of how the likes of Apple computer got started in the late Steve Jobs' garage. It's a story that's been told that the garage was where some guy geeks hung out. It's viewed as the birthplace of Apple computers. But the lesser known story is how integral women were in the tech revolution, tracing it all the way back to the mid-1800s. The new book is Broadband, The Untold Story of the Women Who Made the Internet. Author Claire Evans is a journalist, app developer, and musician. She's based in Los Angeles. Claire, welcome to the program.
I'm delighted to be here. Hi.
So when you write about these women, oftentimes you had to hunt for them. They weren't in plain sight in how we talk about tech and how we understand the origins of the internet. How did you dig for these women and to find these connections to where we're at today in technology?
Well, I did a lot of reading. I did a lot of talking to people. But the most interesting and somewhat maddening thing about this history is that these stories are just below the surface. They're not super, super, super obscure. The minute you start asking people, the minute you start poking around, cross-referencing some footnotes, just looking, you will discover a wealth of material about women's stories. And the stories that are in the book are really only the beginning of a much larger body of stories that has been there all along, which makes the whole thing a little bit even more frustrating than I already anticipated it would be.
I was struck by how oftentimes it came up in your book that these women had had influences in their life at a young age, whether it was a father who worked in computing or a brother who was really into computer programming, but that had influences on these young women at a young age, even your father working for Intel. And there's this one point in your book where you're talking about Marissa Bow, who was a teenager in the 70s. Her dad worked for Control Data Corporation. They're living in Minneapolis. And she really saw the influences of taking risk, of doing something that everyone else wasn't doing, and taking a risk. How did risk influence where these women took technology?
Wow, that's a great question. Something you point out that I think is very true is that access is really important. I mean, if you at a young age are able to have access to computers, to the internet, to technology, you will feel a level of familiarity and comfort that can lead to mastery. And that's why it's so important that, you know, young kids have access to the technologies that are going to be informative in their lives, and that that access is not limited to young boys. That all kids can, you know, sort of face the computer equally. And it's true that a lot of women in this history managed to find their way into this field through things like fathers and brothers, or, you know, generous teachers, or strange historical circumstances that allowed them, like Marissa Bow, to have access to certain technologies that other among their peers did not have. The younger we can be when we're facing this stuff, the better. As for risk, well, I mean, all innovation takes risk, right? I mean, you have to take a chance on something new in order to make a real impact in this world. And I think one of the most exciting and wonderful things about technology is that when a technology is very nascent, when a technology is new, there's often no precedent, no canon, no established way of tackling it. And in that sort of moment of ambiguity and newness, people can stake a claim. And a lot of the women in the history of computing got into technology in these very formative eras where perhaps it might have been more difficult for them to break in when things had become more established. But when, for example, you know, in the earliest days of programming, when computer programming was barely even a word, let alone an idea, women found a way into that and were able to make serious contributions because it was new enough that nobody knew how important it was.
You also show that there's a lot of fluidity, that there are programmers, there are engineers, there are academics, there are hackers, but there's a lot of ebb and flow. People, there aren't clearly defined roles in tech. How did that help shape and perhaps impact women's contribution to the internet?
Well, I think, you know, it can be difficult to break into the highest levels of academic computer science or hardware engineering or, you know, government and military contractor work, which is where a lot of the early internet technology was developed. But there are always, there's always a need for people in the sort of more human-oriented side. And one of the things that I found in this history is that, you know, by circumstances of history, a lot of times women were able to weasel their way in, for lack of a better word, into tech by working on things that were more user-oriented, by developing things like hypertext or sort of, you know, online community, publishing, things that aren't necessarily conceived of as being classically technical, but are just as important and relevant to the development of a technology as anything in the hardware or in the infrastructure. And I think that's something that has been ignored or glossed over or sort of taken for granted in other histories, is this idea that, you know, the internet is a human technology. It's a social technology. It's something that is, that touches us very profoundly in every aspect of our lives. It's not just a box and some cables and some fiber optics. It's something much bigger. And it's very important to make sure that we privilege in the history those people who are contributing to the development of the technology as a cultural technology. That means things like publishing. That means things like online community, like information management, things that might not be perceived of as being computer science necessarily, but which are just as important. I think, you know, making things worth linking is as important as developing the conventions for linking.
And before we get to the pivotal moment of hypertext and HTML, let's go way back in time to human computers. What are they and how did women play a role? Who was Maria Mitchell?
Yeah, I mean, for close to 200 years, a computer was not a thing. It was a job. It was something people did for a living, as in, you know, performing computations. Human computers are the human infrastructure that developed most of the early scientific age. When there were larger calculations to be made, they were made by groups of people working in offices doing mathematics in a kind of distributed way, sharing the task. And those people were far and above historically women, dating back to the Industrial Revolution. Women were doing this kind of work. Maria Mitchell was one of the earliest human computers. She worked doing astronomical calculations. And she was an exception in her day, I mean, because those were early days yet. She was a famous astronomer in her time. But after Maria Mitchell, there were, you know, generations and generations of women working in this work. And it was considered to be, you know, and you'll hear me say this again and again throughout this history, it was considered to be less than important work because it was this kind of brunt labor, you know, much like people working in a factory. It was this kind of mental factories of people doing work. It wasn't considered as glamorous as being a mathematician or being a senior scientist, but it was just as important because it made a lot of these important scientific discoveries of the 19th century possible. Because, you know, you need to do the math. And before computers were there to do the math, somebody had to do it. And it was usually women.
What was so cool is that you were able to spend time with these modern day tech leaders and people who have made contributions in the 80s, early 90s especially. But going way back in time, you didn't have that one-on-one connection with someone like Ada Lovelace. What is her role in the history of technology and the internet?
Ada Lovelace is this very fascinating character. She's often cited as being the first computer programmer. And that's true, although she was writing computer programs before computers as we know them exist, which makes her accomplishment, I think, doubly more fascinating. She was an aristocrat in the 19th century. She was the daughter of the poet Lord Byron, a very mathematically inclined person, a brilliant mathematician, who managed to make a major contribution by connecting with a scientist named Charles Babbage, who was creating these kind of incredibly ahead of their time, very steampunky computing engines.
Did you just say steampunky?
Yes.
Claire, translate, please.
You know, if you look at an image of these machines that he created, these machines called the Difference Engine and the Analytical Engine, they're huge. They're machines. They're not computers as we know them today. They're these massive constructions with interlinked brass cogs and gears. You know, they look like a sort of science fictional fantasy or something. But they are They were the earliest computing machines, and they established some of the formal conventions of computing as we know them, as we know it. And Ada, working as a sort of interpreter for Charles Babbage, a sort of mathematical interpreter, created mathematical proofs for how one would put mathematical problems onto these machines and process them. And those proofs in their sort of convention, you know, defined many of the tropes of computer programming as we know it today. And you know, it took 100 years for anyone to even understand what she had done. And it wasn't until the beginning of, you know, the computer age as we know it today that scientists were able to look at her work and realize that she had written computer programs before the machines even existed.
Claire Evans is with us. Her new book, talking about it, Broadband, How Women Have Shaped Tech Through the Ages. And you can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Are you a woman in a job involving technology in the internet? What do you do? Do you think about your contribution to where this technology is today? What do you make of what it is or isn't focused on when it comes to the history of technology? Call in. You can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're hearing the stories about the women who helped make the internet. Claire Evans' new book is Broadband. She follows the stories of women in computing from the mid-1800s-ish to the early 1990s. We're talking about it on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Before we dig further into these stories, let's get the latest update on the spring membership drive.
Well, and of course, the latest update is always, what's the phone number or the web address to make your pledge? Mike Crane here with Michelle Johnson, and we'll give you an update on the totals, too. But the web address to make your pledge is WPR.org, or you can give us a call at 888-202-2552. Your gifts keep the programs, all the programs that you enjoy, going strong on WPR. So get in touch, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We are looking for 23 pledges in about the next 35 minutes. Thank you so much if you have already given.
But if you haven't, give right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Your gift funds the programs like The Morning Show that you count on and enjoy.
We get such great guests on the Ideas Network because they know you'll ask great questions and they won't be interrupted by commercials either. Your support makes this possible. You are the most reliable source of funding for WPR programs. Give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
How about becoming a sustainer, giving a monthly gift and setting it up to come from your bank account or your credit card? If you do that, it will continue for as long as you'd like.
Because WPR is one of those things that you never want to live without. Provide reliable support with a convenient, flexible, sustaining membership. Get started right now with a gift of $10 or $20 a month at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Now let's admit it. Sometimes we spend money on silly things.
I blew my $8 on this cable. I've got another cable just sitting around the house doing nothing.
Postage to send a care package to my son in Texas that was outrageously expensive.
It might have been dryer sheets on Amazon.
It's pretty easy to make a questionable decision about how we spend our money, and it can be just as easy, and not a bad idea, to make a few sound investments along the way, like supporting Wisconsin Public Radio. Listener support is the single largest source of funding at WPR, so make a sound investment with your gift to WPR right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
It's easy to do that. Just get in touch. WPR.org, 888-202-2552. Mike Crane here with Michelle Johnson, helping to raise the money that keeps Wisconsin Public Radio and all the Ideas Network programs you enjoy on the air. Whether your pledge is $10 a month or $100 a month, we appreciate and we count on your gift.
You know, time flies, and maybe it's been longer than you realize since you last gave to WPR. We're asking you to keep your membership active.
Because you depend on WPR. Like other services you pay for, right? The internet, your phone. We are asking you to recommit your support to WPR right now with a gift of whatever amount works for you at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Your pledge right now is so important at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And thank you so much.
We're exploring a new book on the history of women in computing. The book tells about women in the 1800s and then gives us a much more recent history. We learn about the late Red Burns, for instance, the godmother of Silicon Alley, that is New York's technology district. The book is Broadband, the Untold Story of Women Who Made the Internet. Claire Evans is with us. You can join into the conversation with your questions, your experiences of women navigating the tech field. 800-642-1234. What do you think is the role of women in the future of technology and the internet? Where does it go from here? You can call in, tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Claire, as we look at this timeline and as we move across the continuum, let's stop with Grace Hopper. Who was she and how was this the next step in programming?
Well, Grace Hopper liked to call herself the third programmer of the first computer. And what she was a mathematician. She taught at Vassar right before World War II. And when the war began, she enlisted, hoping to contribute to the war effort as a cryptographer. What ended up happening is that she was dispatched to the basement of a laboratory at Harvard, where she came face to face with a machine called the Harvard Mark I, which was one of the very first computers. You know, computing history is full of all these contested firsts because a lot of these early computers were developed in secret during the war, so it's often difficult to say which one was the first, but very, very early machine, and certainly something that she would have had absolutely no precedent for, no manual, no instructions, nothing, just this massive room-sized machine that was whirring and clanging and full of hundreds of miles of cables. And she had to figure out how to translate some of the most important, you know, ballistics problems of the war onto this machine. And in doing so, she sort of formalized a lot of these protocols for programming, you know, from scratch. She had to essentially bootleg an engineering education in order to figure out how to do this. I mean, she had to look at wiring diagrams and take pieces of the machine apart just to figure out how to make a program work on this thing. And throughout the war, she ran operations for this machine. She was in the Navy, so it was treated like a submarine or something. They were just in the basement, you know, at all hours of the day and night, working on math problems for the war. And then after the war, she became a really important figure in the development of what was then called automatic programming, which is simply just the idea that computer programming could move beyond the sort of very elemental binary instruction set and into levels of abstraction that would make it possible for us to develop things like programming languages, which are, you know, what are the lifeblood of computers today. So super fascinating character.
And we learned, too, I learned a new acronym that I just wasn't familiar with, Electronic Numerical Integrator and Computer, ENIAC. So there was this ENIAC 6. What did they do?
It's very similar to what Grace said. They were also operating kind of in the basement of the war theater. I mean, all these early electromechanical and electronic computers that were developed in the US and in the UK were being developed to run things like ballistics calculations, mathematical problems for the war effort. And, you know, because women in those days were already working as human computers, like we discussed earlier, doing applied mathematics, and because software wasn't seen as something more glamorous or more important than patching cables, like a telephone operator, essentially, or handling punched cards like a secretary, which were both women's jobs. So, you know, since women had been working as human computers for several generations, it seemed natural that they would handle their replacements. And the same thing happened with the ENIAC, which was at the University of Pennsylvania. A group of women from the human computing group at Penn were enlisted to figure out how to put problems onto this machine. And again, just like Grace, they had to figure it out from scratch by taking bits and pieces apart. And it's really remarkable that you know, in the process of teaching themselves the workings of these machines, they came to understand the computers just as well, if not better, than the engineers. And not only that, they had to sort of develop what the heck programming was going to be. I mean, there wasn't even a word for programming. One of the ENIAC-6, Betty Snyder, called the job a cross between an architect and a construction engineer, which I think is pretty accurate. You know, it's got this sort of very delicate artistic side to it, but it's also very pragmatic. And, you know, it was through the work that these women did during the war and after the war that programming became something that had its own value, that was separate from just the menial manipulation of hardware. It became a language, it became an art form, it became this incredibly powerful force in our world. And it draws its roots all the way back to these women working on computers during the war.
But it seems, too, that women have often ended up on the side of software. Why is that? And what has been the influence there that you have seen in your research to software?
You know, I always hesitate to say that, you know, there's like some kind of natural intuition for software that women have. You know, I think that's a very... it's an often trotted out binary, you know, men are hardware, women are software. And you see that in sort of the working relationships of these iconic computer people like Ada Lovelace, who was on software while Charles Babbage was working on hardware, or these women in the 1950s working, you know, on early computing machines were doing software. But they were only doing software because it wasn't yet determined to be something different than pushing buttons on the hardware. Yeah. It wasn't determined as something that had its own value. And, you know, for that reason, I think, you know, I think one of the earliest ENIAC programmers basically said that if the men had known how important this was going to be, there's no way they would have let the women run it. It just wasn't seen as being important. But I think because women were able to articulate that space and do so much powerful work in programming in the early days, perhaps there's a kind of legacy there that we can tap into in terms of software development. But, you know, software was, you know, one of the reasons that women were kind of pushed out of computing is when coding, programming, software was sort of professionalized after the war, when it, you know, the computing industry really became an industry. You know, there was a kind of consensus to move away from language like programming and to start calling it software engineering, because engineering is something that has you know, it has professional credentials. It has a kind of clear academic path.
Perhaps more manly?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of historians have suggested that, yeah, the professionalization of computing led to the masculinization of computing, because it sort of started to make more formal these roles, which had been so open-ended in the early development of the technology. You know, I think the early programmers were self-taught. There was no computer science department they could go to. There was no degree in programming they could get. They came to it kind of by chance through the circumstances of the war or in the early computing industry, because they were good at, you know, puzzles and math, because they had an aptitude for it, not necessarily because they had gone to school for it.
Well, let's jump way ahead here to the late 1960s. And in 1967, there's this Cosmo article titled "The Computer Girls," suggesting that women were being encouraged to pursue programming as an alternative to working as a secretary. What was the field like at this time in the late 60s for women?
It was a transitional moment. I think, you know, the early pioneers, the Grace Hoppers and the ENIAC 6, were beginning to sort of age out of the field. And so there wasn't a ton of mentorship for women. But at the same time, there were a lot of openings for women in computing. The problem was that those openings were starting to cluster kind of at the lower end of the occupational pool. It was less, you know, higher level systems work and more, key punch operators and really much more menial jobs. And it was sort of beginning to take on this kind of secretarial quality, whereas the more sort of serious software engineering was being done by men. But even, you know, in the 1960s, there were still a lot of women in computing. And the crazy thing about women in computing, I think, is that, you know, we think of computing as being a really male-dominated landscape. But, you know, like in the 60s, women were more or less half the workforce in the industry. And women earned 40% of the computer science degrees at American universities until about 1984. So, you know, that number has, you know, started diving in the mid 80s and has kept diving to this day. You know, it's a decline unrivaled by any other professional field. But, you know, for a good chunk of time there in the early history, there were plenty of women working, both in these kind of lesser secretarial capacities, but also in as programmers and software engineers. So our idea that tech is male-dominated is really a historical anachronism that's only reinforced itself over time as being somehow natural, but it's not.
We're on a tour of women's contribution to the cyber realm. Author Claire Evans was able to interview most of the women who have been on the forefront in recent times as she crafted together these vignettes of women in tech history. We're talking about her book, Broadband, on The Morning Show. Now let's pause and get up to speed on the spring membership drive.
Sure, it's great to be here and listening to this fascinating conversation. And it's funny hearing the term human computer when it just needed to be computer because that's the only kind of computers they were, just like you now say acoustic guitar. It used to be just guitar. Mike Crane here with Michelle Johnson and experiencing a program that is one of, I wish I had known that before, and I'm glad I do now. You have that feeling all the time. Your gift to WPR makes a huge difference in the opportunity to provide listening like this. And listeners are the single largest source of funding for WPR. So how about you? Can you help fund WPR at WPR.org or 888-202-2552?
We're looking for 22 more pledges in the next 20 minutes. And your gift right now, it's so important because when you give, you support the programs that you rely on every single day.
And thanks if you've already given. But if you haven't, the time is now. Give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I am loving this conversation this morning. We're talking about women's role in pioneering in the internet. It's a hidden history. And, you know, these are conversations that you would only hear on the Ideas Network. The idea that the internet is now part of this sort of integral and essential part of our lives. And we take it for granted. We don't step back and think, how did that get made and who made it? That's the kind of listening that you can have on WPR, on the Ideas Network. WPR is listener-supported, and that means when you give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552, you make this hour and many more other hours possible. So choose an amount that works for you and take a few minutes and make your pledge.
This spring membership drive, we have a special opportunity. Ask for the Reach Out and Read thank you gift when you give $10 a month or more. Your thank you gift will provide books to young children during their wellness doctor visit. Donate now and you'll support the WPR programs you rely on, and you'll be helping Wisconsin kids get a good start in literacy. Make a pledge, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I would ask you, if you're a listener, you know, why do you listen? And if you're listening now, then you want to be listening in the future. And if you've listened in the past and the future rolls around and it's not there, you won't have anything to listen to.
And I guess I would tell you that it's NPR and WPR, National Public Radio, Wisconsin Public Radio. And you are its public. And the funding for WPR and NPR comes from you.
I'm Larry.
I'm Ellie.
And we're from Madison, Wisconsin.
And please join us as sustaining members of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I listen to public radio and I'm a sustaining member. That's kind of cool.
22 more pledges to go, 20 minutes to get them. You make WPR possible when you give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
It is kind of cool if you're a sustaining member, so how about becoming that? By the way, you can do two things that are really great at once. When you make a donation to support WPR, you can also ask for the Reach Out and Read thank you gift, which provides books for young children. That's available when you give $10 a month at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Your gift is powerful. It really does make a difference at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Thank you.
Author Claire Evans writes that as a movement, cyberfeminism disappeared with the popping of the dot-com bubble around that Y2K timeframe. Remember that? And She makes this really sharp observation that as the web commercialized, it became clear that the internet was not going to solve sexism. It wasn't going to solve classism or racism or ageism, and the list goes on. It's this really astute observation that as we are in this moment with the Me Too movement, with very consequential conversations about data security, and then there's this history of women. Claire Evans' new book is Broadband, The Untold Story of the Women Who Made the Internet. We're talking about it on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, gathering your perspectives on how women have contributed to tech and the cyber realm. 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Are you a woman in a job involving technology and the internet? What do you do? And do you think about these pioneers who came before you and what your legacy will be, where you are taking the field? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Claire Evans, help us now. Take us to modern day, where you had so many conversations with tech leaders who are here today, and the descriptions you make of them, and especially there's this one, Jake Feinler, who, I mean, you even tell us what side of her head she parts her hair on, and we learn about how she pulled these all-nighters with the best of the guys. What is her story?
Oh, Jake Feinler, to me, it's criminal that she hasn't been more celebrated already, because she ran something called the Network Information Center, which was essentially the central hub for the earliest version of the internet, the ARPANET. Back in those days, when we first started connecting computers to each other, there wasn't any kind of interface for navigating the early network. It was something that was meant as a resource-sharing network for computer scientists to access computing resources at a distance. So if you were a computer scientist in Massachusetts and you needed to use a computer at Berkeley, you'd be able to dial into it. However, you wouldn't necessarily know what was available on that computer unless you called this office that Jake ran, the NIC. And, you know, I call her the one-woman Google of her day, because she was the only person who knew where everything was online. She was the person who administered what was called the host table, which was the way that new sort of sites on the network could become established. They would have to join the host table. She was the person who handed out addresses for the earliest domains on the ARPANET. She was the person who kept the sort of yellow pages and the white pages of the early internet. She knew who everybody was. She answered the phone for the internet. For close to 20 years, there was a phone number you could call if you had a question about what was online or who was online or how to use these resources. You would call this office, and Jake or one of her many female employees that worked in this office would pick up the phone and help you and connect you to those resources. So, you know, she is this kind of remarkable character, because she was one of the very first people to understand that the internet isn't a piece of infrastructure. It's not necessarily just a tool for computer scientists and engineers to access other computers at a distance. It's absolutely an information technology, and it's a cultural technology. And, you know, from the moment that email was invented, she was inundated with it, because she was the one who was kind of like dealing all this administrative stuff.
She was like ground central of email, you know.
Yeah. In fact, you know, when I interviewed her, I asked her, you know, at what point did you realize your job was going to be difficult, if not impossible? And she was like, immediately. You know, the moment the internet started growing exponentially, she realized that she was going to be snowed in. And, you know, I think she was one of the first people to really contend with a lot of the problems and issues that we talk about online today, which is just that it's this massive information repository. And the way that we navigate that information, the way that we organize that information, is always going to have a huge impact on what we understand to be true about the world.
Does she have strong feelings about how information is organized today?
You know, it's funny. You talk to these early, early internet people, and they are just as stymied by the modern day internet as any of us. I mean, it's so different from what it was. And it has exploded at such a massive scale that it's like a different thing completely. You know, it's completely different from what they were dealing with. They see the kind of crumbs, the early sort of intimations of the direction that something's going to go. But you can't anticipate something like Facebook. You can't anticipate, you know, these disruptive technologies. You can't anticipate the mobile internet, which has completely transformed the world. It's so far away from where we were.
But there was Echo, which was traces to really early roots of social interaction, social media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Echo is another fascinating thing. It's one of the earliest online communities. I think at this point, one of the longest operating, continuously operating online communities, founded in 1989 by a woman, of course, named Stacey Horn, who ran it, you know, a stack of servers out of her apartment in New York City. Completely visionary, you know, very, very, very early, realized that people were going to want to communicate with one another through computers. And she really put it all on the line. She staked all of her money onto this idea, and she has continued to maintain it to this day. And the remarkable thing is, you know, she founded this online community at a time when only 10 to 15% of the online population was female, but her service had nearly perfect parity. I think she had a little bit over 40% female users at a time when there were barely any women online, because she was the only person that was trying. And because she made design decisions in the design of her system that would make it so that women felt safe and represented on the network, which is something we still probably struggle with today.
And Claire, your book comes out at a time when here we are in the Me Too movement, here we are in very major discussions over data breaches, data security. How does this conversation about the timeline of women and the role of women in the internet have into the greater context of what we're talking about here today and the issues that we're having with technology?
Well, I think, you know, something that I think about a lot is simply that there's nothing inevitable about the way that the platforms we use work and function. I mean, the internet and the web and the way they work, they're all the consequence of countless small decisions made in the moment by people, you know, driven by very human needs and desires and informed only by the circumstances and the context of their moment. You know, nobody knew what it would become. Mark Zuckerberg founded Facebook as a way to judge the relative hotness of incoming freshmen at Harvard, and now he's the most powerful man in the world. Nobody meant for that to happen. And what I mean to say is that, yeah, there's nothing inevitable about these platforms. And, you know, although it's easy to feel locked into the way things are and to feel sort of fatalistic about the various scandals that rack our systems, you know, had these things unfolded even slightly differently, we'd be living in a different world. And in a sense, that makes me feel, you know, grateful for the kind of broad human vulnerability of it all. And it makes me realize that, you know, we made choices and we can continue to make choices, that we're not locked in and we have the freedom to decide, design, take action, and really define what it is that we want out of these systems. And I think right now we're in a moment of conflict or sort of a moment of reckoning. We're realizing the impact that some of these platforms and technologies have on our lives. But I think that's good because it makes us understand that we still have some agency and we can actually define what it is we want.
Along the way, did you find that women encouraged other women in this? Women encouraged others into the fold? I'm thinking of the late Red Burns, the godmother of Silicon Alley. How did women bring others along?
Oh, I mean, yes, always. I think whenever there was the possibility to do so, women always do that, I think. I mean, and it's funny, I mean, looking at this history just from a kind of zoomed out way and just looking for women in this history as I was writing this book, I tended to find women in concentrations, in clusters, because where one woman arrived on the workplace, wherever she was able to, she would bring other women in. So you look at, you know, Jake Feindler's Network Information Center, she hired women, she hired her friends, she hired people that she thought were interesting and smart who weren't necessarily computer scientists or even secretaries or even, you know, one of her number twos at the NIC was an art teacher. She just hired people she thought were good for the job. Same in the early programming days, you know, women supporting each other, working together. It's something that comes up again and again. And I think you know, we talk a lot about diversity in the pipeline, but I think as soon as we get to a place where there is even a slightly larger percentage of women being represented in technology, that number will only grow because women, I think, do have a tendency to want to lift each other up and bring each other into the fold. So I think if we can encourage that behavior, then we will be out of the diversity problem faster than we think.
Claire, has your view of what you call cyber feminism, has it changed and will it continue to evolve in the future? Or did it change as you wrote this book?
Yeah, I think, you know, cyberfeminism can mean many things. There was an art movement in the 90s called cyberfeminism that was a very sort of an early claiming of the space for women. I think, you know, there was this sort of utopianism in the first generation online, I know people really believed, and you mentioned this earlier, but people really believe that networked culture would allow us to connect with one another mind to mind, you know, without any of the limitations of gender, race, sex, class, ability, age. We know that has not proven to be true because, as it turns out, we bring everything with us into cyberspace, as we do with everything, because we're humans. You know, we bring the best of ourselves and the worst of ourselves. The network has just become kind of the Venn diagram circles have overlapped completely, and now computer life, internet life, and real life, whatever that means, are more or less the same thing. And so we're not dealing with this kind of separate place where we can project our aspirations for a better selves. But I do think that, you know, it's always going to be a very human thing, but if we can acknowledge that and start doing the work sort of on a societal level, then we can only improve the systems in which we take a part. And that includes, you know, making ourselves a more feminist society. I think perhaps then the network will become a more feminist network.
Claire, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Claire Evans is a journalist, app developer, musician based in Los Angeles. Her new book is Broadband, The Untold Story of the Women Who Made the Internet. This hour of the morning show was produced by Brianne Chasso and Jane Rotunda. Michael Derringer provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and now let's switch gears and see how we're doing on our spring membership drive.
Well, we're doing okay. We could use some more help from people that are listening right now. How about saying thank you for a fascinating conversation with Claire Evans by making your pledge of support, because it is an essential piece of the funding for the Ideas Network. Listener support is the single largest source of funding for WPR. Mike Crane and Michelle Johnson here, and we invite you to get in touch right now. Make your pledge, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We are looking for 21 new pledges in the next 5 minutes or so. We can do that. These hourly goals are set up to make sure we have the funding for the programs you enjoy. So make your donation right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Claire said so many fascinating things in this hour, including that nothing is inevitable about how the internet works. You know, we're used to what it is now, but the history is remarkable. A lot of it should have been and now is being told is taking place because of women. And just a fascinating conversation. And, you know, WPR is listener supported. That means that when you give, you're supporting conversations like this. So give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And you've helped then to make this hour and many more hours possible. Choose whatever amount works for you. Just takes a few minutes and make your pledge.
The beauty of making a voluntary contribution to WPR is that you decide how much to give. It could be a gift of $100 or $200 a month.
And that might be what you pay for cable or your family phone plan. Listening to WPR is something you do every day, so please put a value on it, like other things that are important to you, at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
My name is Michael Sigmund. I'm a WPRA board member. I think it's more important to find a reason to contribute, but you invest in a service. You're providing anyone with a wide range of potentially stimulating ideas, images, and sounds before they're written or performed or spoken or sung. There are so many reasons, and you can find more than you can ever imagine.
It's really easy to make your pledge, WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Mike Crane here with Michelle Johnson, asking for your support during our brief spring membership drive, because it's that membership support that makes the WPR programs you rely on possible. So make a gift of $10 or $20 a month or whatever amount you choose, because that is the right amount.
Now is the time. Pledge right now while you're thinking about it. It just takes a few minutes to contribute.
You'll have a good feeling of supporting the programs you love, so make that feeling come to you right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Show your support for Wisconsin Public Radio, and remember to ask for the Reach Out and Read thank you gift. Your donation will support the program that you rely on, and your thank you gift will provide books for young children.
We had a great comment from Zach from Platteville, who says the only way a person can properly contribute to society is to be well-informed And WPR provides you with that opportunity. So go ahead and make that pledge of support, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Your pledge right now is so important at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And thank you.